Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Wyndham Hotel in downtown San Jose. I am Mary Les Castro, your chair for today's event. We would like to welcome the listeners of KPBS FM 89.5 in San Diego, one of more than 225 stations nationwide, joining us for America's longest-running radio program. It is my pleasure to welcome Cindy Chavez, a member of the San Jose City Council, who will introduce today's speaker. Ms. Chavez was named as an outstanding woman of Santa Clara County in 1996 and in 1997, received a Woman of Achievement Award in honor of her many civic and professional activities.
Welcome, everybody. Today, we are pleased to welcome the Honorable Jesus Reyes Heroles, the Mexican ambassador to the United States. Ambassador Reyes Heroles holds a bachelor's degree in economics from the Instituto de Tecnológico Autónomo de México and a doctorate in economics degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He holds an impressive list of government positions, including the Chief of Staff to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. He oversaw operations at Mexico's Infrastructure Development Bank in 1994, and in 1996 was appointed the Minister of Energy. Ambassador Reyes Heroles was an active member of the PRI and worked closely with the PRI leaders. He was an advisor to the party's Institute for Political, Economic, and Social Studies, and later coordinated the National Ideology Commission. Ambassador Reyes Heroles has also served in the private sector as the co-founder and CEO of an economics consulting firm. The ambassador has been a staunch supporter of trade liberalization and NAFTA. He has also spoken and written about a number of key issues concerning U.S. diplomacy, education, and immigration. Mexico is now the second largest trading partner after Canada to the United States, recently surpassing Japan. With many of Silicon Valley's corporations and industries heading south, more companies are trying to reap the benefits of this new economic relationship. In 1998, Mexico purchased over $1 billion of products and goods from Silicon Valley alone. Today, the ambassador will share his insights on the new California-Mexican joint venture, so to speak, and diplomatic relations. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Reyes Heroles.
Thank you very much. Huh? Thank you. Next time you should do it in Spanish.
I will.
Thank you, Ms. Chavez, for your very kind and generous introduction. I can hardly express how honored I am to be here today addressing this very distinguished group of individuals at the Commonwealth Club of San Jose, which I'm told is the oldest Commonwealth Club in the United States on continuous operation, and I know for sure that it is one of the most prestigious in this great nation. I want to thank very from the bottom of my heart, Mrs. Duffy, Mrs. Compton, for your support to this project. And although he's not here today, Alex Torres, who has been very supportive from the Hispanic Chamber, he left just a few minutes away. He's here. Hi, how are you? He told me that he was going to leave early today. Thank you very much. This is my 12th trip to California over the past 18 months to 2 years. And that is simply a reflection of the importance that President Zedillo has given to the relationship of Mexico with California. Since I arrived here a little bit more of 2 years ago, one of the clearest instructions I got was to intensify our relationship with this great state. The view that has been held, and it's clear, is that there is no way we can have a good relationship with the U.S. if we don't have a good relationship with California. That it is through California that many of our links, of our bonds, go through. And we have been working on that, and I think that during this last visit, I have been able to attest the new attitude, the new mood that is growing in terms of that relationship. I'm not going to really devote a lot of time to speak about it. Usually when one addresses a group like this, devotes a lot of time to concentrating in the specific trade or economic relations that exist between the state and between our country. And California, in that regard, is an easy case to do. Let me simply present to you a couple of facts in 1 minute. It is estimated that exports from California to Mexico reached the historic figure of $15 billion in 1999, although the official figure is still not out. What we know is that during the third quarter of last year, Mexico surpassed Japan to become California's leading export market through the first putting it in position to become California's largest year-end export. And we have to remember that Japan's economy is 9 times bigger than Mexico's economy. So in relative terms, our effort and our presence here is more. We have to keep working hard to keep that happening in the near future. In the first 5 years of NAFTA, California exports to Mexico have increased 72%. Today, California is the second largest U.S. state in exports to Mexico. 9 of California's top 10 export sectors to Mexico showed growth during the first 9 months of 1999, strong growth. Examples, electronics up about 5% and remaining California's largest export category, accounting for about $3.5 billion. Industrial machinery up 10%. Fabricated metal products up 17%. Rubber and plastic up 18%. Apparel up 22%. I think these figures speak for themselves in terms of the nature, the intensity, the strength of the relationship, the economic and trade relationship that we are gradually expanding. I could speak more about it. We could all talk about more about it. But on this occasion, if you allow me, I would like to spend some time speaking about other non-economic, non-direct benefits of free trade and economic modernization. Let me start by trying to spell the, we know, but it's important to remember it, the role of free trade, that free trade can play in our challenge to meet high rates of growth in the regional economy and in the world. It's clear that mankind constitutes the major assets for the future of the world, and no better place than San Jose as a proof of that. However, it also represents its main challenge. To be capable of feeding, housing, educating, and providing jobs for this vast number of people, rapid and sustained economic growth is needed. There is no question about it. The main challenge of the first century of the new millennium is to successfully face the challenge of growth. But to grow, the world economy requires more capital, which in turn can only be sustained by higher savings. How to increase production to allow for both consumption to increase and at the same time encourage saving? Only by increasing overall efficiency. This job requires allocating the world's resources in the best possible manner. which implies improving productivity and competitiveness in the different regions of the global economy. It is clear that sound macroeconomic policies are essential for achieving this growth. But balanced fiscal deficits, budgets, and tight monetary policies are not enough. A continuous increase in flexibility for markets is indispensable, and it requires further deregulation and the elimination of distorted elements. I think over the past few years, many countries have achieved a lot in this regard. But more is required of us if our aim is to keep efficiency of the global economy at a pace that will make allowances for growth of such high and steady rates. More efforts have to be placed in expanding infrastructure and develop human capital. Investing in education and the development of technologies is the key source for continuous gains in productivity. Only open international markets allow us to have an accurate reading of economic opportunities worldwide. In a context of scarce resources, nobody has the right or can afford to allocate resources to an activity which will yield less production, less income, and therefore less welfare than other projects. In our global economy, free trade becomes a switchboard for the transmission of accurate economic signals among nation states and international economic actors. By performing this task, free trade contributes to global expansion, but the benefits of international trade are more far-reaching. In the economic arena, by enhancing growth, trade sets the stage for increases in wages and improvements in labor conditions. If more jobs are created in a context of raising productivity, the opportunity emerges for reducing the differences in incomes between workers and families across the world. Although growth is not a sufficient condition to reduce inequality, it is a necessary condition for it to happen. It is clear that more urgent action is needed to translate this into a less unequal society. But there are also non-economic benefits of free trade to which we put less attention. Let me mention some of them. To start, there is a correlation between the opening of markets and the development of democratic regimes. This has been the case in the last decade, both in Eastern Europe and in Latin America. Free trade and free markets enhance economic opportunities, increase available information to the society, constrain bureaucratic discretionary decision-making, and make politicians and officials more accountable to domestic and international actors. By doing so, free trade contributes to democratic practices. Free trade is not the main driving force behind democratization, that's clear, but it does facilitate and stimulate the process of democratic change and consolidation. Global trade stimulates accountability and therefore contributes to the reduction of one of the most damaging problems for economic growth and public morale, corruption. The interconnection of markets and enhanced transparency, which comes with trade liberalization, become critical elements for reducing discretionary powers and economic rents, both of which are well-known sources of corruption. Free trade has also contributed in a direct manner to erode corruption. As multiple firms from various nations compete to get access to domestic markets, both for investment opportunities and trade deals, those using corrupt practices and bribery may believe to have advantages over others. But as free trade has made the procedures of international transactions more transparent and homogeneous, there has been no more room for bribery and corruption. There is no doubt that free trade has implied some costs, at least in the short run. Adjustments are needed both in specific sectors and firms. Sometimes they are concentrated in a particular region that endures the pain of economic restructuring. Since gains for consumers and producers are scattered around and the costs of adjustments usually fall in a few firms and activities, Benefits are difficult to portray, while the costs become an easy story for special interest groups and the media to disseminate. We should not be discouraged by these natural difficulties, but take them as an item of the agenda to work, to keep working on it. This lengthy commentary might seem abstract and distant from us, but it is not. It has a correspondence in the reality of many countries which recently engaged in more ambitious free trade regimes, and Mexico is no exception to this. Since my country entered GATT in 1986, engaged in a unilateral opening of import markets until 1993, and finally, since NAFTA was implemented in 1994, Mexico has been the recipient of the economic and the non-economic benefits of trade liberalization. On the economic front, despite the 1998 international financial crisis and the collapse of the price of oil in that same year, Mexico's economy has been growing at an average rate of 5% over the last 4 years. Employment has also been expanding. It is estimated that from 1995 to 1999, Mexico has generated about 3.1 million new modern jobs. Those are defined as jobs where the people have a formal labor relationship. They are inscribed in Social Security. They pay Social Security contributions, and they pay the corresponding taxes. In addition to those, there are self-employed and other kind of activities that had to be added to this figure. Despite the economic adjustments needed to face changes in the macroeconomic scenario, industrial wages have been growing at an average rate of between 2.5% to 3% in real terms. Wages in export-oriented activities are 30% higher than those in non-export-related activities. Mexico's trade has been growing steadily, not only with our NAFTA partners, but also with several other countries. In 1999, total exports reached almost $130 billion as compared with $52 billion in 1993. Furthermore, non-oil exports became the dominant product sold abroad. In November 1999, oil exports accounted for only 8.6% of total exports as compared with 31% in 1987. It goes without saying that the upsurge of exports has brought about an extraordinary increase of imports. For example, those flowing from the U.S. to Mexico rose from $45 billion in 1993 to $104 billion in 1999. That is an increase of 131%. Preliminary figures indicate that total bilateral trade between Mexico and the U.S. reach a historical figure of $210 billion in 1999, which compares with $88 billion back in 1993, the first year before NAFTA. Today, Mexico, and it has been said today here, has become the second largest trading partner with the U.S. This extraordinary expansion of non-oil trade, especially of manufacturing goods, has only been possible due to a rapid and far-reaching modernization of Mexico's productive plants. Obsolete factories were closed or reconverted into modern ones, state-of-the-art, environmentally clean, competitive facilities that flourish in many regions of the country. Gains have also been extraordinary in Mexico's entrepreneurial spirit. Today, Mexican businessmen base their daily decisions on the behavior and tendencies of international markets. Transactions with the rest of the world have become a key element of these results. They have learned how to close international deals, how to borrow from Exim banks, how to bridge disputes, how to bring disputes to panels and arbitrage for their solution. In other words, they have lost their fear and now actively participate in foreign markets. Along with trade liberalization, deep changes have occurred also in the political arena. Only since December 1997, Opposition parties in Mexico have won 7 governorships, which is more than all the governorships won by the opposition in the previous 60 years. Today, the opposition governs in 11 states, including Mexico City, 8 million, as well as many of the most important capital cities such as Monterrey, Guadalajara, León, Querétaro, and Mexicali. Finally, in 1997, there is a divided, since 1997, there is a divided government in Mexico, which has allowed the opposition to oversee the administration and force the executive branch to negotiate with Congress on every piece of legislation. Today, we can firmly ascertain that there is a real system of check and balances in Mexico. Although by many counts, Mexico's progress over the past years has been tremendous, many old and new challenges still remain. The benefits of growth have been felt all over, but they have been trickling down only slowly. The relief of changing demographic trends and job generation has not only been enough to reduce underemployment, has not been enough to reduce underemployment and substantially ameliorate migration to the United States. The financial system was severely damaged by the last crisis. It requires more capital, new regulations, and creative management to recover its essential functions. Mexico's public finances require a major shape-up, so that they can contribute efficiently to support basic social programs, while at the same time fostering private investment and competitiveness. New rules have to be defined in terms of the expenditures in critical areas, for example, the way to keep attracting and hiring the best and brightest to the government to keep their in critical functions. Mexico's educational system also has to be evaluated and redesigned based on its capacity to meet the requirements brought about by globalization, to mention only a few of the challenges. On the political front, cementing our new democratic institutions and procedures and reaching a most needed and desired final solution to the situation in Chiapas are critical priorities. We still have to see how the problem with the National University evolves over the next few weeks and months. In closing, let me say that when assessing Mexico's situation and prospects and how does that play in the relationship with California and with the United States? One has to look to the role that Mexico is acquiring in the international economy as a major hub for international trade. That means that Mexico has been working stubbornly over the past few years to acquire the privileged position to keep gaining from penetrating in the global economy. Based on its free trade agreements with the United States and Canada, NAFTA, with Chile, with Venezuela and Colombia, with Costa Rica, with Nicaragua and Panama, the one recently negotiated with the European Union, and the one whose negotiation finished only last week with Israel, those being negotiated with Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, Mexico is acquiring a privileged situation for challenging, for facing the challenges of this new century. I think that few countries can claim the benefit of such a strategic positioning. We are confident that we will continue to move ahead to cope with globalization and development without losing in terms of our national identity, because we have a rich, strong, and powerful cultural heritage. Precisely by remaining Mexican and keeping our language, family tradition, and values, we have been able to become increasingly important actors in the global economy. For all these reasons, I think that it's time to think afresh about the next stages that we have to encounter in terms of a closer economic and political relationship between the United States and Mexico and between California and Mexico. And in doing so, as compared to 1994 or 1989, we have a very good record, a lot of progress that has been achieved with the help, with the work of many peoples on many people on both sides of the border. I think that now there is a confidence that we can do things together, that we can prosper and move ahead if we talk to each other directly, if we sit down in a table and engage to deal with complex problems that are brought about by neighborhood, but also to gain and to benefit out from the opportunities that also arise from that extraordinary neighborhood. Thank you very much for your attention. I will be more than pleased to address any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor embajador Jesús Heroles, for your remarks here today. Now I would like to introduce Edwin Garcia, who will cover our question and answer period. Mr. Garcia has been a reporter at the San Jose Mercury News for 7.5 years, the last three as the newspaper's Latin Affairs reporter. He has won several journalism awards for his role in three special reports: Santa Clara County's population turning majority-minority, the Latino migration to the U.S. heartland, and a series of articles that documented how Mexico-bound remittances sent by migrant workers to their families are lost in transit. Mr. Garcia?
Thank you, Marilis Castro, our chair today. Mr. Ambassador, we have a large number of questions for you from the audience, so let us begin. How has NAFTA affected Mexico's small farmers and indigenous populations?
One of the sectors where the need for adjustment has been greater in Mexico is precisely the agricultural sector. It was anticipated. It was no surprise. The basic issue is basically is that it's hard to compete with the U.S. in terms of the production of basic grains. We don't have a Mississippi. Essentially, that's the reason. And the idea is to have the capacity to benefit from the extraordinary productivity of the American agricultural sector and to use that in the benefit of the Mexican economy as a whole. But what does it mean? It means that relatively small exploitations, relatively small farms with low productivity that used to produce corn will have and have been moving out of that production into different activities. The process has been very complicated and slow. It takes capital. It takes knowledge. It takes technologies to be able to transform production units who in the past used to produce corn or other basic grains into vegetables or fruits. There are many success stories also, but it is clear that some of those units were affected by NAFTA and have carried a very large of the burden of the adjustment involved with NAFTA. I have to simply conclude saying that the smallest plots, the smallest of the operations, the poorest of the farmers, have not been affected in such a degree because they are basically devoted to self-consumption. And that is that they are not interconnected with the market, and therefore they are more cautioned from that. The government put together a couple of programs to deal with that. One is called Procampo, which is basically a program that includes income support payments to owners of properties, small properties. And the second one is a program of promotion of the transformation of the agricultural sector that has been working for the past 3-4 years. That's what I can comment about that.
Thank you. Since Seattle and the WTO protests, opponents of globalization and free trade have received a great deal of attention. What do you make of their arguments?
I think that there is a mixture of ideas that emerged in Seattle. And regretfully, the meeting did not allow everybody to sort out and to differentiate these ideas and the implications of each of them and our capacity, joint capacity to respond and to react to them. There is clearly a need to evaluate and to analyze what free trade has been bringing to different regions in the world. There's no question about it. There are many benefits, and there are some other things that we have to correct or to amend. Maybe the way that the costs have been distributed is not fair. If that's the case, let's sit down and figure out how to address that particular issue. There are clear linkages between trade and other aspects of our relationships, like labor standards or the environment. NAFTA has two parallel agreements where it was the first agreement that included that, where we have been trying to address those issues in a way that helps us to find solutions and at the same time do not stop or do not interfere with trade. There is also some fear that in the way of solving this, we can create barriers to free trade, confusing really the problem. Free trade is needed for the global economy to work efficiently. And it needs to work efficiently because it needs to generate growth, because we need the growth to generate employment, because that's the only way that we can provide means for a growing population, for a large population worldwide. So let's deal with the related aspects with trade, but let's do it in a way that does not neglect or minimize the benefits that are brought about by free trade.
Thank you. And why has Texas had better relations with Mexico than California?
I think you have to ask the Texans. Well, very briefly, one observation. Geography plays a key role in that. Basically, Texas is right there in the middle. If you want to go by land to the U.S., in 80% of the chances you will meet Texas, and that's not the case with California. Both Baja California and California are, let me use the expression, a little bit geographically far away from the rest of our nations. And therefore, they have their own dynamics, which is very different. No other, if you ask me, no other sub-region of the border, there is this notion that there is a special interaction like you find, for example, in the San Diego, Tijuana, Ensenada region, precisely because they are a little bit more by themselves. No?
Does the role of the governors not play a role in that?
I don't know. I wasn't here.
Thank you.
Ambassador.
What is the Mexican government doing to stop the drug trade? And how has the drug war affected U.S.-Mexico relations?
Let me start with the second part of that question. It has affected it very much because it has distorted the true agenda. It is the aspect that gets more attention, and it is not the most important aspect. It might be the most urgent. It might be the one that is at this particular time easier to portray or to present, but it's not the most important one. So it has had a cost in terms of distracting our attention from other issues and distorting the view that each other have about the other country, especially the view of the in the U.S. about Mexico. What has been done, what is being done? Mexico and the U.S. have by far the largest program of cooperation against the scourge of drugs that any two nations have put together. It's a very complex, integral, ample program. It has about 16 different action items that order our activities in that regard. On both sides, we have been working to put the needed resources there to be able to fight this scourge. We have been constructing a lot of institutional linkages and mechanisms of communication to make sure that our agencies don't work one against the other, but they work jointly against the common enemy, who are the narco-traffickers. To spell in detail the many actions that are being done is clearly beyond the possibility in this meeting. But let me stress the fact that for Mexico, the fight against the scourge of drugs, it's a number one priority. President Zedillo has defined drug trafficking as the number one enemy of national security in our country. We are a country that is between the producing countries of drugs and the main consuming markets of the world. We are a country where drugs go through from one place to another. We have to keep those drugs out of Mexico because once they get into Mexico, they already have caused the harm. They bring violence, they bring corruption, they bring money, they affect the health of our own people. And at the end, it's really very difficult to stop them to get into the U.S. There are new additional programs that have been in place to keep the drugs out of Mexico, and I'm happy to report that we have been getting fairly good results in preventing drugs being introduced into Mexico by plane. Last year, there were only two incursions of planes into Mexico. This is an example. Both of them were identified. Both of them were followed. Both of them, in both cases, the cargo was seized. For you to have an idea of what this means, in 1995, there were about 40 incursions that nobody knew where they landed, where they dropped the cargo, and what happened with the drugs. So it's a big difference. We're working now more on the sea. Sea interdiction has become more important because as we advance and become more successful in sealing the airspace, then they are using the sea. And now there's a new program sharing information and intelligence data with the U.S. Agencies. And over the past few months, better results have been achieved. So that's the front we have where we have to work harder now. And for the U.S., we know they are making efforts to move ahead in diminishing, reducing the consumption of drugs, which at the end of the day will be the only sustainable, long-lasting solution to the problem.
Thank you. Can you explain what happened to the project for privatizing petrochemical industry in Mexico, and why did it fail?
Well, it's a question of my previous life. That regards, the first attempt to do it had some legal flaws. It did not, it was not consistent with the constitutional mandate about the role of the Mexican state with petrochemicals. It took us a lot of effort to change the law to make sure that we all understood where was the line where the public sector would work and where the private sector would come in. That is clear since 1996, and private investors in petrochemicals now, foreigners or nationals, have full certainty that if they invest, for example, in an ethylene cracker, it is within the realm of activities that can be developed by the private sector, and it's legal to do so. I think that the one of the critical things that is still missing is the definition of the prices of the feedstocks. You can have the best scheme to privatize. You can have legal certainty to invest in a country, in petrochemicals, for example. But in that industry, it is critical to know at what price they are going to sell you your feedstocks, your inputs, for a long period of time. And it's a complicated decision because there are long-term contracts and there's not a clear market for such goods in the world, because usually in other parts of the world, those inputs get into the productive chain and they are not sold by themselves. Several ideas have been explored, both internally in Mexico and with foreign investors, including the possibility of, that was an old idea of us, to actually define auctions of some of the inputs, long-term contracts to supply those feedstocks to the companies so that they can have certainty about the supply and the price. In my view, this is still one of the key issues pending. Once that is resolved, I'm sure that we will see much more investment into large, important plants in the Mexican petrochemical sector, especially in the chain of the ethane, because Mexico is ethane rich in that regard overall. Thank you.
As an elected school board member for Meet San Jose, I am painfully aware of the critical shortage of bilingual teachers. What can we do to recruit and train teachers from Mexico to work in our schools? Our district has traveled to Spain, Portugal, and the Philippines to recruit teachers.
Well, I think that's something we can solve. I don't know exactly what is putting a cap on the resources that you can get from there. Let me work that out, if you allow me, and see the specifics and figure out what we can do in that. I know that we have successful programs with other regions. The case of L.A. Is a very large program that has been very successful, and I don't know what differences there might be between what you are doing and what they are doing, but we certainly are at your disposal to find out a way to help to make this move faster.
What can we do in Silicon Valley to reduce the digital divide in Mexico?
We were talking about that today in the morning. Actually, we were asking ourselves that. And not only what you could do here, but what we could do over there. I don't have the elements to answer that question now. I think that emphasis has been given in Mexico to try to push the access and the capacity of our students and kids to computers, but much less than what is needed. The resources won't be there to have wide coverage of that in the nation. How can we figure out a program of, for example, I don't know if it makes sense to start with, but to recycle some of the used equipment in ways that can equip the schools, rural schools in Mexico or other places where otherwise they won't have an access to the, such equipment. How can we figure out exchange programs where we can work during the summer in some places and they can come up? You can bring 2,000-3,000 kids and to different places, and they work 3 months in something like that. A lot can be learned, just to create the appetite and to allow them to have the first experience of sitting there and talking with the machine and talking with the system. That is what we need to do. What can be done in terms of having facilities in key places in Mexico where that experience can be facilitated to some of our kids? Those are questions that I am raising myself. I don't know exactly how to respond to them. I have never thought about that. I'm extremely, after these 2 days, a day and a half here, I'm extremely interested in the issue we were talking. And let me, whoever pose that question, if you can approach me later on, I would more than pleased to devote some time to work with you and to try to figure out some reasonable solutions that are viable in an emerging economy, in a country like Mexico, where with the restrictions that that we have and the resources that we have.
How do you see the maquiladora industry transforming into a high technology industry?
I don't see that. The maquiladora regime is coming to an end soon, and that's because NAFTA is advancing. There are some issues, taxing issues, that are being solved for the maquiladoras. But I think in terms of the way the question is phrased, what we have to think is how do we give an additional impulse to the manufacturing of high-tech equipment in Mexico. It doesn't need to have the label maquiladora anymore, because under the normal regimes in Mexico, there won't be any, with free trade and with tariffs at zero, you don't need to have this concept or this special figure, which was created years ago, because there wasn't free trade to actually do what you want to do. So I think I would rephrase the question and saying, what do we need to give an additional impulse for Mexico to have a larger share in the international activities of producing high-tech equipment?
What is Mexico's feeling regarding the English-only initiatives that are popping up around the United States? I didn't hear.
Well, we have been always very respectful of the decisions that the U.S. takes in regard to the way they want to conduct their own policies. I think in terms of the advantages and disadvantages of following different routes to train and to teach to our kids in the in managing one or several languages, there are many questions. It's not clear which one is better. I have heard, I read several papers last year about that, and I could make up my mind about it. And I'm glad I don't have to take the decision myself in terms of what is what seems to be better. The only thing I can say is that I think we are moving into in the world into some kind of bilingualism, and especially in this region of the world. And we, what we have to figure out is how is that we can train on both sides of the border more people to get there faster. And On that, I really leave it to the experts and to the people who are in the schools to define what is the best way to get there, and I would simply follow what they recommend. Thank
you. Will the PRI be able to hold on to the presidency?
Well, the current surveys and polls do give an advantage to the candidate of the PRI versus the candidate of the National Action Party. The difference is less than what it was some months ago. I think it's not written. It's really an open, very competed election, and that there are still 5 months to go, no, 4 months before the election, and many things can happen. Now, what you see is that the figures for the PRI are more consistent over time than the figures of the other parties. They are very volatile. They depend on many short-term events or reactions to short-term things. So I really don't know what is going to happen, and therefore how these other figures for the other parties are going to move. So what we have to wait to see is what you do here, which is to wait until the election date and see what is the result that we will have in Mexico.
Explain why Mexicanos in the U.S. still cannot vote in a Mexican election here.
Well, formally, because the Congress decided that they were not going to decide about that, essentially. So there were several items, several issues of the electoral reform that different parties wanted to discuss. They were so controversial, several of them, that they decided simply to postpone the discussion for a later period of sessions. So we will have to wait for the Congress to resolve formally. Now, let me simply clarify the fact that Mexicans now have the possibility of having dual nationality. If they decide to become citizens of another country, assume that it's the case of a U.S. citizen, now they don't lose their Mexican nationality. But we make a distinction between nationality and citizenship. The traditional distinction between nationality and citizenship was that to be a citizen, that means basically the capacity to vote, you had to be Mexican to start with. You had to have the nationality. And in addition to that, one critical requirement was to be a resident of the place where you wanted to be a citizen. For diverse reasons, in the last law, they sort of removed that restriction, and they said, we will define the rules later on to see who of those who are Mexicans but do not reside in Mexico will have the capacity to be also citizens and therefore vote. Those rules are those that are not defined yet and that the Congress will have to define. That is the reason why, as you can imagine, it's a very controversial issue for its implications on our electoral system, and also for its implications for the community of Mexican origin that lives in other countries, especially in the United States. I could expand on this, but I think I would leave this. If somebody wants a more detailed explanation, I would more than pleased to speak to he or to she with she or he.
Will Mexico oppose a Bracero program in agriculture and support an amnesty program for undocumented workers in the USA?
Well, there are two different things. The Just the use of the word bracero becomes very complicated for us. In Mexico, there is not, neither here, there is a good remembrance of the bracero program, especially of its latest stages. The question refers really to what is called the temporary workers program. And it's clear that a temporary workers program is not good or bad by itself or in itself. It depends on the characteristics of the corresponding program. Think about, well, the case of Mexico. Mexico has a program of temporary workers, agricultural workers, with Canada, which has been there working for almost 20 years. It's a small case program. I think it moves about 7,000 or 8,000 workers every year. And nobody has had any quarrel with it for the last years. The same workers go and return every other year, and it works well. Well-crafted, well-done, small scale. I'm not saying that that's an example. It's something that happens. The point I want to make is that, you know, we have been seeing some of the proposals which are here. They are too vague, too general, and we cannot really come out and express an opinion about something like that. We are following that closely, but that's where we are at this stage. Let me simply conclude saying that we are not actively looking to negotiate with the U.S. any kind of temporary workers program, which is something that has been sometimes in the media. That is not accurate. It's not part of the agenda. We are not pushing for it. On the second part of the question, which is the amnesty, I was very surprised by the article that I read today in your newspaper, actually, about the meeting of the AFL-CIO in New Orleans this week, I gather, where they sort of the AFL-CIO came to with the notion that consideration had to be given to a new amnesty program. It's something that we in the past have seen the benefits that amnesty has had for fellow Mexicans who are residing for or have been residing or living in the U.S. for a long time, and that obviously their own conditions, their human conditions and their own welfare improves dramatically when they change from being undocumented to being documented. However, I want to stress that is a decision for the U.S. government or for the U.S. to take, and we will simply look at it with interest from our perspective without having any specific position, only signaling if they asked us the implications that something like that would have for our people, for the Mexicans.
We have reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and that question is, Mr. Ambassador, if you were a U.S. citizen, which presidential candidate would you vote for and why?
What a great question.
I don't know, because all of them are in favor of Mexico, so... Thank you very much.
Our thanks to the Honorable Jesus Reyes Heroles, Mexican Ambassador to the United States, Cindy Chavez, San Jose City Council member, Edwin Garcia, San Jose Mercury News reporter, to our audience here in San Jose, and to those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting at the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, is adjourned. Thank you.
Muchas gracias. De veras le agradezco.